The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We have asked everyone in Wales to make changes in the way we live our lives.
Stay at home during this pandemic.
Welcome to Journos in Lockdown,
a podcast created by trainee broadcast journalists who are learning to report in a global pandemic.
As we've not been able to go out and meet journalists, we've decided to bring them to you and ask them what challenges coronavirus has brought them
and what the future of journalism might look like.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Journos in Lockdown. My name's Evan John, I'm a trainee journalist, and I recently had the pleasure of talking to Laurel Chaw from Hong Kong. She's a visual journalist who's worked for National Geographic, Vice, The New York Times, and many others around the world. She's recently returned home to Hong Kong after spending almost 2 months in lockdown in France. And on a day when a crackdown by the Chinese government upon dissent in the city loomed, we talked of her storied past, the strange present, but also an uncertain future. Here's the full episode. Laurel Chaw, hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, cheers. First off, you're in, what is it now, day six or day seven of your home quarantine in Hong Kong?
It is day seven or eight. I'm out in 5 days.
Who are you staying with in Hong Kong?
I live with my mom.
How's that being back?
It's nice to be home.
Is she happy to see you?
Well, yeah, it's been almost 2 or 3 months that I've been gone, and I've been gone most of the year. So it's nice to be home. It's nice to be able to eat local food again. It's just nice to get back into things. I think being in Europe was a break, but it's nice to be busy again.
And what did you do in France while you were there for, you know, that extended period?
I did work a little bit. I did a few shoots for the Bloomberg News wire agencies. So I showed how Lille was really empty. I did one shoot about how there was a drought affecting wheat farmers. I did one shoot about the first car factory reopening in France after the lockdown. And yeah, so I mean, they were different from my usual work for sure. And the topic, there only one of those topics were not coronavirus related. So still a little bit of work. But other than that, I just sort of rested, slept a whole lot.
I guess a lot of people, either voluntarily or involuntarily, have had to draw back. There's almost been like kind of no choice.
Yeah. And you know what? I think for me personally, you know, as someone who's very privileged, you know, no, I don't have any dependents. My expenses are pretty low. So I was lucky that I was able to afford to rest. And I sort of reset my processes, tried to implement good habits that I'm still trying to keep up, and just did a lot of reading. So it was a really restorative time for me, and I'm grateful that for me it could be that way, though of course that makes me very, very, very lucky compared to most of the world.
I wanted to ask about your journey back to Hong Kong. I mean, you know, first off, why now? Why did you choose to come back just over a week ago?
Well, the French lockdown was ending. It ended 2 days before I left. And so in Hong Kong, I knew things were starting up again. You know, June 4th was probably the next major date I was looking for. That's the anniversary of the Tiananmen massacre. And normally Hong Kong does a huge commemoration every year, so I knew I'd want to be back for that. And schools were opening up in Hong Kong again. I thought about how maybe I'd want to document that, and I wanted to be back in time for that. So it just, plus, I mean, the tough thing about traveling back was, first of all, especially with the protests, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. And even in the time I've been in quarantine, so much has happened. And no matter when I went back, I'd have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. So I wanted to get back in time to be out of quarantine for anything that happened in Hong Kong.
I mean, in terms of your work, it's not only global in the sense that you work all over the world, but it's global in its scope as well. How did it feel being, I guess, not in control of the events, which restricted you in what you could do in your job? How did that feel?
Yeah, I think the beginning was pretty tough. I I felt really guilty about not doing more to cover COVID. I felt like I should be out there doing my job as a journalist. And it was pretty jarring to, I mean, same with everyone, right? Just to have everything canceled all of a sudden. So it kind of did make me wonder, you know, question a lot of decisions I made. You know, there were jobs I had turned down thinking I had other options, but, you know, I didn't end up having other options. I mean, I don't regret anything, but, you know, it was just a lot of uncertainty, which I'm used to as a freelancer who travels a lot. But, you know, being uncertain just about how the world was going to work and how my work as a freelance journalist was going to fit into that was tough. And as a photographer, you can't really do all that much if you're stuck at home. So it was tough, but I'm generally an optimist and I took the time to rest. And now being back in Hong Kong, things are still, well, I don't want to say normal, but restaurants are open. There's no lockdown. People aren't being asked to stay at home. So I'll be able to work here, thankfully.
I mean, I had a question for you as a freelancer in terms of how you do your job. I mean, I was thinking for example that you had a lot of waiting time when you were getting tested and during the transit period on the way back to Hong Kong, and you were live tweeting it. And it went viral, of course. I mean, I heard you on Radio 4.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Do people listen to that? I honestly don't know. So.
Yeah, I mean, my dad listens to it. I quite like it. I just wondered, for example, with our course, we've been taught how to work within a broadcast organisation. I wondered how, as a freelancer, your working day and, you know, your working life differs and how you manage that.
Well, I think one of the reasons I wanted to go freelance is because I like working in different mediums. So it's pretty difficult to find a job, difficult but not impossible, to find a job where you are given the freedom to do different things. You know, I like to take photographs mainly, but I also produce videos. I also write. I also host videos. You know, I do TV appearances, I do radio. So I like having that freedom. I like being able to pick and choose. I like challenging myself and trying different things. But of course, being a freelancer comes with a lot of challenges. You really have to hustle. You really have to basically be constantly working. You have to always be reaching out to editors. You get rejected all the time. So it's tough, and I think, you know, I definitely don't have any separation between work and personal life. I think over the last year, there's been so many times when, like, I'll be at the gym on a Friday night and I'll be like, why is it so empty? And I'm like, oh yeah, it's Friday night and regular people go out on Friday nights and they have their weekends off. So your whole schedule is very different. But, and you know, it requires a lot more discipline because, in theory, you could just stay in bed all day, right? But you really have to.
And then you're not getting paid.
Yeah, and you're not getting anything done. So it requires a lot of discipline and hustle. But on the flip side, you get freedom and you get to only really do things that you really want to, even if you only really want to for the money. So I like the freedom. It hasn't even been a year and a half. So I'm still relatively new to freelancing.
I was watching some of your productions for Vice, like the video on social credit in China, and then the Year of the Dog video.
Yeah.
I mean, I just really liked the scope of them and, you know, the real kind of personal focus. I'm not sure it's a question really, but I just want to say I did really like those pieces and the way that you went about the journey.
But I mean, so for example, like last year, if I were working for an international organization, there's absolutely no way I could have covered the protest the same way that I wanted to. You know, it's a very, very personal story and I basically wanted to cover everything and constantly. Whereas if I were still working for Vice, I would have had way more other responsibilities. I would have had to cover stories elsewhere in the region. I wouldn't have been able to cover, you know, things that aren't deemed international news, which is most things. But as a freelancer, I was able to try my best to cover everything, at least be there even when I wasn't being paid, even when I wasn't on assignment. Especially these days with social media, I can still tweet about things, and that's still doing my job, even though it's, you know, not paid, or put things on Instagram, and still do my job as a journalist, albeit for free and for nobody. But at least people will see it. Some people.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of try to take hope from that, in the sense social media can be awful, but it can also be really, you know, really brilliant for disseminating information. There's a lot more ways of getting the story out.
Definitely. And I think for me as a freelancer, I've been really fortunate to be able to grow my reach and grow my platform, and, you know, allows me to be sort of pickier too, because if I'm able to reach my audience directly, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, I don't have a massive following. I just have a platform where we're able to reach a few thousand people. And so when I have this option of telling the story my way, is it worth compromising for telling the story in a different way? Because when you tell the story to an international audience, it's always going to be different. Like, you know, for Vice, you know, I'm really proud of the work I did for them when I was working for them full time, and I'm really proud of the work I did for them as a freelancer. But when you tell a story for an international, particularly Western audience, it's going to be in a lot less detail. It's going to lose a lot of nuance. It's going to be shorter, because you can't expect the US audience to watch a 15-minute video about some, like, parliamentary proceeding in Hong Kong that no one even in Hong Kong really understands. Basically, it's a balance. You have to, and that's the nice thing about being able to pick and choose. I get to pick what story to do and how, you know, if I have the options.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of advice for younger journalists and people coming up, is it a case of putting in the work first and then getting to a position where you can have a bit more freedom, a bit more autonomy?
I mean, you know, to be clear, I'm not saying anyone's tried to, like, manipulate what I wanted to say, but for me, my personal journey and path as a journalist, I'm really glad that I worked full-time at first. I think that's how you learn, that's how you get the training, that's how you learn from your colleagues, that's how you learn what it's like to be in a newsroom, or just from people who have more experience than you. And, you know, in my first job, I was just working for, like, a local blog, but there I learned how to write. That's how I learned to, like, not just write, but write really quickly. That's where I learned how to shoot and edit videos on my own, because it was such a small organization. If I wanted to do something, I had to do it on my own. But at the same time, I wish I worked at a bigger organization. Or not that I wish. You know, there were things that I couldn't learn and that I wasn't learning because I wasn't at a big organization with, you know, people who could mentor me or edit me properly. But still, I learned a lot there. And then I moved on to Vice, where I learned so much about producing and filmmaking that I probably would have literally had to get, like, a master's in filmmaking to learn. So that was really valuable. And then having had that experience, I had already, you know, had all this portfolio of work. I had worked in a lot of countries. I knew journalists just having been in the scene for a few years, and having those contacts plus that portfolio and, you know, a reputation amongst those contacts, that allows you to become a freelancer. I don't know how I would have become a freelancer if I just became one straight away. I, you know, none of my skills were good enough to be a freelancer when I was starting out, for sure. I'm glad I had that time to learn and improve over the years.
So a bit of patience then, a bit of holding your nerve.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's totally understandable. I was there too. I think when you want to become a journalist, but you're a young graduate or whatever, you think, you know, I want to dive right into the most important international stories and travel the world and do all these cool things. But of course, that's great if you can achieve that. But at the end of the day, as a journalist, you have a responsibility to the people whose stories you're telling, to the places you're going to. And if you don't have the experience to tell the stories properly, to do the stories justice, and to reach people, then really it's kind of just selfish. So I think journalists, young journalists, definitely have to be patient and really work on their skills. And also, like for me, another thing that I'm really grateful for with my first job was that I was telling local stories. I was telling, you know, quirky stories about my own home that were underreported, that international media would not care about, or even just bigger media wouldn't care about. And that really helped me develop an eye for a story. You know, it wasn't about doing a story because it was a super important international story. It was telling a story because this was important or it would be interesting to people in my immediate community. And that is a really great feeling. And it's possibly more impactful than being the 10,000th foreign correspondent to tell a story about some major issue, when you could be the first and only person to tell a story that will touch people back home.
You're listening to Journos in Lockdown.
I mean, I'm not sure how much you know about the UK situation, but we're all in different stages at the moment. I think we're all looking a bit enviously at countries who have handled it better. I mean, I know Hong Kong has handled it better. There was already a lot of experience with the SARS outbreak in 2003. And so now you're kind of in a position where stuff is kind of going back to normal. I mean, I was going to ask, what is that new normal we're going back to? And then, of course, yesterday we got this news about the National Security Bill, which, you know, for those who don't know, is the People's Congress in China are going to go over the Hong Kong government's head to introduce a bill that would allow them to sort of crack down on what they call terrorism, secession, dissent within the sort of special administrative region. It is a big question, but what next? What happens next?
Yeah. As far as what's just happened in Beijing, I honestly don't know what this will mean for Hong Kong people's daily lives. People are very worried. I'm really worried. For the first time, I'm wondering, you know, is my future in this city at stake, and will I have to leave? And that's not a question I've really considered before. So it is scary, but at the same time, you know, I think things like this will take time to really show. Like, you know, it's going to take time to establish offices of whatever security agencies Beijing wants to have in Hong Kong. And it's going to take time before they actually act. We don't know whether they're going to be as strict as they are in China. We don't know if they're going to start throwing people in detention without a lawyer as they do in China. We don't know. But in the worst case scenario, which doesn't seem unlikely considering what just happened yesterday, was probably even worse than the worst case scenario anticipated by experts. Hong Kong becomes absorbed into China, and there's no longer one country, two systems, and we just become a part of China, and that's it. And that's pretty horrific. In terms of coronavirus, as long as the borders remain closed, I think we'll be okay. But I think, you know, the coronavirus isn't going to go anywhere in any country. It's not going to go in any country or any territory until there's a vaccine, which at this point for me, if there's a vaccine in a year and a half, that doesn't seem that long from now. So, yeah.
I guess this virus has obviously been an interlude in our personal histories and our personal life plans. I guess it's the same for Hong Kong. It's been an interlude in what has been an extended period of protest, of unrest, you know, tension in the city. When things go back to normal, whatever that normal is, are we going to return to what we've seen in the last 10 months?
You know, had it not been for the news the last 2 days, I would have said it would have been something like that, probably with a bit of a stricter crackdown, a harsher crackdown. But with this new law, if it really does pass as soon as next week, then I don't know, because, you know, the implications, the punishment, until now, despite everything, Hong Kong protesters were still going through the Hong Kong system. They were still going through Hong Kong laws.
I mean, at most you could get, you know, 4 to 8 years for rioting, but that was in Hong Kong, in the Hong Kong system. But now we might have a situation where Chinese state actors could detain people in Hong Kong. You know, they could arrest people in Hong Kong.
Right. Yeah, does this now mean... And the protesters have been called repeatedly terrorists by Beijing and by Chinese state-owned media. So they've almost been really sowing the seeds for this. They knew, we knew, everyone knew, by calling them terrorists, you're essentially calling them, well, terrorists and secessionists and everything that under this national security law is a huge crime that who knows how people will be punished and who knows, you know, will you have to throw a Molotov cocktail to be taken for that? Or what if you just say something on social media? Is that enough? Which is the case in mainland China. So that's what has people really scared right now, because in Hong Kong, we still don't quite have to worry about that. Not in the way they do in China.
I wanted to know what your perspective was. You know, we've heard your perspective as a Hong Konger, but what role does the press have in this, in what's to come?
Well, I think the media has been, of course, super important in covering what happened last year. That's how the world knows about what happened, and it was a major story, so we had a lot of international media on the ground, and we also have a lot of international media who are based here to begin with, so it's their home too. The media is how the world, of course, knows about what's going on, and that's how we reach people, and that's how it possibly affects things. But with coronavirus, the borders are closed, so I don't think international media will be able to get in if they're not here already, of which there are, you know, there is a fair amount. In terms of whether we'll be able to work, it's unclear, because the government, the police, have repeatedly made comments about how biased the media is, about fake journalists. Just the other day, a show was taken off the air because it was a satirical show and they made fun of the police.
Oh yeah, was that the RTHK program?
Mm-hmm. So things like that make people really worried. And there's a whole string of things that have happened over the years that have sort of eroded the freedom of press, and add to the national security law, who knows if we'll be able to really work entirely freely. You can't work freely in China as a journalist.
You talked about how these protests, you know, from last June kept you at home in Hong Kong. And you obviously talked about how there's a sort of different resonance, a different meaning when you're reporting on something that's your, you know, in your home. You're reporting on events that are affecting your home and your life. I just wondered if you could expand how it feels to be reporting and dealing with these events that affect something so personal, so close to you.
Yeah, covering the protests was definitely really tough. You know, you sort of have this first row seat to the deterioration of the rule of law in your own city, in your own home, and that's pretty difficult to witness. But at the same time, I think sometimes I feel less helpless than my friends who aren't journalists, because for me as a journalist, I feel like I'm doing the best I can as an individual to do something about it. Whether it actually makes a difference, who knows, but at least I'm doing something. And I think for a lot of people who can't, it's a lot more difficult, and to have to witness it from afar is probably harder. So for me, I'm glad I can be there. I know for a lot of people, a lot of my friends who are abroad, it's so hard to not be home when your home goes through something so major. And I'd felt it before too. I'd been abroad for certain events. I was abroad when the police cracked down way back in June. I was there for the first march, and then I was gone for work, and then the crackdown happened, and I came back straight away in time for the second march. Or, you know, there's a lot of things I missed that were really difficult, and it's so at least for me, I can be there. But of course, it's super emotional. It's super draining. You don't have that emotional separation that you would if you're telling a story about somewhere else. No matter how empathetic you are, no matter how sensitive you are, as you should be as a journalist, it'll never hit the same as when you're reporting about your own home. And these are issues that, of course, affect me, affect my future. And I think it also makes me double down because I realize that as a local person who is able to reach international audiences, I can tell a story. I have a voice that isn't necessarily there when other international media are reporting on it because they've flown in people who don't necessarily know as much about this place. So yeah, it's difficult. You know, the news the last few days, it's been pretty devastating. And still processing it. But it's hard for sure. But again, at least as a journalist, I'm part of a system that hopefully can fight for freedoms and rights that everyone deserves.
How do you look after yourself?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I did. In the second half of last year, looking back, I realized how burnt out I was, but I generally have pretty good habits about exercise and what I eat, even though my sleep definitely suffered. So I just tried to be as nice to my body as possible and spend time with loved ones and spend time with my dog and spend time outdoors and you know, all that exercise and nutrition was important, not just for my mental well-being and my physical well-being, but also for my job. Like, to be able to work those protests as a photographer, you have to be really fit, or you just have to be able to endure pretty terrible conditions. So it kept me going, both for myself and for my job. And again, that's why I'm really grateful for the break that I've had thanks to the pandemic. Again, it's like an extremely privileged position to be able to take, but for me, it was a break that I really needed.
Yeah, I mean, you've still been working while you're quarantined. What have you been doing day to day? Are you quite eager to... Are you counting down the days a bit?
I'm not really. I mean, the only thing that bothers me is that I might miss some major protests with the news coming out. There might be big protests this weekend. I know it's going to be extremely hard not to be there, but, you know, really nothing I can do about that, especially considering how high profile my return was. Everyone knows I'm supposed to be in quarantine. I've been really busy. I mean, I was really lucky, or for whatever reason, my tweets about coming back to Hong Kong went viral, and that brought a lot of work opportunities. I probably did more work in the last week than I did in the previous 2 months. But gosh, since I've been back, so I've been back a week, what have I done? I've written a piece for The Guardian. I've written a piece for The Independent. I've filmed and edited a video for Euronews. I filmed a piece for Vice, which included interviews with other people in quarantine. I have pitched a whole bunch of stories. I have done so many radio interviews. I didn't even know there were so many BBC channels. I've done quite a few TV spots. So I've been probably forgetting things, but I've been really busy, which I'm very grateful for. It's nice to be busy again, and it's nice to have work, and it's nice to keep my mind off the fact that I'm not allowed out of this apartment. I mean, it reminded me of what it was like for me during the protest, just constant work and constant, you know, juggling all these different clients, like, or just people I'm talking to. Like, this professor sent me an email with all these consent forms, and I'm like, who are you? Why are you sending me these things? How did you get my email? And he, like, sent me a screenshot of a conversation we had on Twitter, like, 5 days ago. I mean, it was super quick, but he's like, hey, I'm doing a study on people arriving from Hong Kong. would you be willing to do it? And I said yes and gave him my email, and I just totally forgot about it. And when he emailed me, I was like, who are you? So that was embarrassing. But that's just how busy I've been. But I mean, one thing I'm really grateful for is some of the things that I learned in quarantine that I would have only had the time to learn in quarantine have kept me sane. So things that I started doing in quarantine, I started bullet journaling. So it's like this trendy organizational system that you do in your notebook, but it's been a lifesaver for me. And you know, while in France, I was meditating every day, I was exercising every day, I was journaling every day, I was reading every day. So I'm really glad that I, you know, made those good habits under lockdown in France, because I think I realize now if I want to repeat everything I went through last year in terms of the protests and covering them, like, if I want to keep covering the Hong Kong protests while taking care of myself, while making sure I don't burn out, while not feeling overwhelmed and anxious and over my head, then those personal systems and processes that I was able to build while under lockdown are going to be essential. I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep it up, but at least I know what I'm trying to aim for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it certainly has an effect. I mean, sort of like going into a maze and coming back out again. You come out of the same spot, but something changed. You're coming at things from a slightly different angle now. I guess with the lockdown, when we go back to normal, perhaps nothing fundamentally has changed, but you have to think it changes something in people's head. You know, something must change when we all kind of go back.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting. On one hand, like you said, I feel like people can't be the same forever. Like, surely we won't travel as much anymore. Surely we will commute less now. Surely we'll value time at home more, cooking more. But on the other hand, you know, maybe we'll forget all of this, but Hong Kong never forgot SARS.
Definitely. So just to sort of round up, I guess now that you're stepping out of this period of this strange sort of interlude, a pause in your life, what are your hopes and fears going forward?
I think my hope is that this whole global crisis is a wake-up call for everyone about the way human societies around the world have functioned so far. You know, the things that we need to change in terms of the environment, the things we need to change in terms of prioritizing what's important in our own lives. But on the other hand, I think I am scared that things won't change and that, you know, we'll have Australian bushfires and we'll have China taking over more things and suppressing more people's rights, and that we'll have more President Trumps and that climate change will go unchecked. And those are real fears for sure. But, you know, not to sound so doom and gloomy for me, and I think this is what I always try to tell people, and is, you know, for me, the only question that matters is are you helping or are you part of the problem? And no one's asking you to change the world or to solve anything on your own. But if we all produce a net positive, then I think we'll be okay.
Absolutely. I mean, as this is a podcast for young journalists starting out, we've already drawn out a few strands from your advice. Leverage your social media because it might get you work. Don't be afraid to start small, start local, put the work in. Do you have any other advice for young journalists coming up?
I think I always just encourage young journalists to work on your skills and build a portfolio, and that in order to do that, you don't need anyone's permission. You know, if you want to be a video journalist, if you want to be a filmmaker, then you should be making videos, even if it's just on your phone cut in iMovie. If you want to take photographs, then go out there and take photos. Like, don't wait for an assignment, don't wait for an editor, don't wait for publication, just go out and tell stories and work on your skills. And yeah, you don't need permission. And I think This is something that I see come up a lot, especially with young girls and young women, is it's hard to be a journalist when you lack confidence. And I think when you're young, then is the time to really work on your confidence, because as a journalist, not only do you have to talk to people and put your work out there, which is a very vulnerable thing, or, you know, call out people, call out authority. You can't do any of that without being confident that the way you think is, you know, rational and worthy, and that your perspective is valid, and that you're smart enough to do these things. So I would encourage, if anyone feels like they're not confident, you really have to take very conscious steps to address that, whether that's picking up a sport to make you feel more confident, which I know is hard in a lockdown, or public speaking or acting, a new hobby, anything. It's something that's really important.
Well, Lowell Chaw, thank you very much. And I'm sure everyone who listens will have the same pleasure that I did talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Good luck with school, with online school.
Lowell Chaw, thanks very much.
And if you'd like to get involved or just share your thoughts on this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter at Lockdown Journos. The Other Evan is back tomorrow with Myron Jones. Until then, stay safe and goodbye.